At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Welcome to another episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. I'm your co-host, Jovana Xavier. In each new episode of New Books in Islamic Studies, we select a new book that has been published in the field, and we have a conversation with the author. In today's episode, we are joined by Professor Joseph Hill, who's an associate professor of anthropology at the University of Alberta in Canada. Rapping Authority, Women Islamic Leaders in the Sufi Movement in Darkar, Senegal, is an ethnographic study of women Sufi leaders in the Talabe Bay, or Fauda branch of the Tanzania. Hill provides live stories of various fascinating and powerful female maqadimas, or Sufi leaders, in Darkar and explores how they navigate the complexity of their gendered authority in religious, familial, and public domains. The book examines the ambiguity of female religious leadership and its manifestation through piety and performance, be it through cooking, motherhood, or the use of a female voice. Hill frames these pious actions through the semiotic acts of rapping as opposed to wailing, as it provides a more expansive analytical framework for his project. This book will be of interest to those who work on gender and women Islam, as well as those who engage contemporary Sufism, West African Islam, and anthropology of Islam. And so without further ado, here's my conversation with Joseph Hill. Hi, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for inviting me.
So you are the author of Rapping Authority, Women Islamic Leaders in Sufi Movement in Darkar, Senegal. So I'm really excited to have you on the show today. And as is tradition in New Books in Islamic Studies, I wondered if you could start off by telling us something about your intellectual journey and what led to the writing of this book.
I have been researching this community, the Fauda Tijaniya community, is how they like to refer to themselves in Arabic anyway, since 2001, when I was doing my PhD research. And when I first went to Senegal, I wasn't really interested in Islam or Sufism. I knew very little about both topics. And I was really interested in music. So I went and I studied a bunch of musical instruments. I learned to play the kora, which is this large, they call it a harp lute. I learned to play the khalam, which is a banjo kind of instrument because I play the guitar. And I learned how to play the sabar drum and the riti, a violin. So I was very much interested in music at that time. But as I was researching, I first went in 1998. That was when I first went to Senegal. I was an undergraduate doing my honors thesis. I decided to do an honors thesis on African music, traditional music. But as I continued in Senegal, as interested as I was in music, I realized that the people around me, most of the people who are not specialists in music necessarily, they might be interested in music. They might put it on at big events or whatever. But what they were really interested in talking about was Islam. They were really interested in talking about, especially what we would call, an outsider might call it, Sufi groups. Although they didn't really use this term themselves. They were very interested in their sheikhs and the spiritual status of their sheikhs and whose sheikh was the most important sheikh. And there were a lot of rivalries between different groups in Senegal. And I found out that, you know, I was as an undergraduate that 90% of Senegalese people are part of some kind of Sufi order. 95% are Muslims. And so I just became fascinated with the culture of Sufism. I wasn't so interested in kind of as a belief system I was really more interested in Sufism as it contributed to popular culture, as it contributed to local culture and identity. I was interested in the night chant meetings that people did. I found the chanting to be fascinating because as a musical person, I was interested in the chanting. And so this just kind of, it kind of grabbed me and drew me in. So when I applied to a PhD program, I at first, actually, my applications, I said I was going to continue my research on griot musicians, who are the traditional musicians in Senegal. But as soon as I started my graduate program, I immediately switched from studying music to the thing that had been really just kind of consuming my curiosity, which was these Islamic groups. So when I went back to Senegal in 2001, I decided to choose a group that I, at the time, thought was a relatively obscure group because you didn't see them on the national scene so much. What you really saw was the Murids, the followers of Ahmed Ubamba, and you also saw the Tijani followers of Al-Hajj Malik Si, who was based in the city of Tiwawan. And I didn't see the followers of Sheikh Ibrahim Niass so much on the national scene. And so I kind of thought, well, I will, in the interest of fair representation, I'll choose one of the groups that's less represented, and I'll study them. And it turned out that I was really quite ignorant about the topic when I chose it as a topic, because it turned out that this was by far the largest Tijani group in the world. It just didn't happen to be all that represented in Senegal. And so it was mostly through, to be honest, the ending up where I ended up doing my research for the last almost 20 years. It was, I'd like to say it was part of a large master plan, but it was mostly just me kind of stumbling around in the dark that led me to this topic. And it's kind of the same thing that led me to study women. When I went to Senegal in 2001, I had no idea, as I explain in the book, I had no idea there was such a thing as a Sufi women leader in Senegal. Because I'd read a number of books and the studies of these leaders in Senegal, Islamic leaders in Senegal, and they all mentioned men. It turned out that there were a couple things that mentioned one woman leader. But for the most part, that was an anomaly. They didn't talk about women. So I was surprised when I went to Senegal during my first week in Medina Bay, the center of the Faida Tijaniya. I was surprised when my research assistant, when I was drafting a list of people I wanted to interview, of notable religious personalities in the area, I was surprised that one of the first names he mentioned was a woman. And I said, really? There's a woman religious leader? And he just kind of acted normal about it. And he said, yeah, if you want to go talk to her, she's just around the corner. The reason why her name came up was because she was kind of a neighbor of where I was staying. So we went and talked to her. And it turned out there were more, as we asked around, there were more women. I didn't really focus on that in my dissertation. My dissertation was much more about the broader themes of knowledge and authority in Sufi Islam in Senegal. It was later that I just started to say, whenever I mentioned these women leaders, people were very interested and people were surprised. And I said, there's so little literature about this. Maybe I'll write a small article about this, maybe a 10-page article. I have enough information I'm not really at the time, I wasn't really a gender expert. I wasn't somebody who was personally interested in gender that much. I just said, the literature doesn't really talk about women leaders. They exist. Nobody's mentioned that. So maybe I'll just write a 10-page article based on the interviews that I had done with about three or four women leaders. So I started writing and I started presenting, I presented a conference paper on it and people started contributing things back to me saying, well, look at the longer Sufi tradition, not just in Senegal, look at other countries. There's Nana Asma'u in Nigeria. There's this and that. And I just started to realize that this was a huge topic that very few people were talking about at the time. And it was around 2009 when I decided that I'm going to turn this into a book, not just an article. So I wrote up a prospectus and I started shopping it around. I hadn't really written all that much. I just, it had just kind of expanded. But by a year or two later, my material had expanded beyond one book and I was looking at two books. So I have another book I'm working on also on a similar topic about gender and Islamic authority, but much broader than what's presented in this book. So it was kind of, one thing leading to another that led me to have an interest in gender and women in Islam. And since then, it's become, as you can see, one of my primary preoccupations academically.
Yeah, and it certainly is. And then one of the things I was curious about, because ultimately this particular book is an ethnographic study. Yeah. And in your introduction, you do speak a lot about kind of your own location as a researcher and you're navigating points of accessibility and non-accessibility as a male researcher. So I wonder if you could share some of that methodological process, which you've alluded to already. But in terms of how the interviews went or the people who you were working with.
Yeah. So you know, when I present this research, a lot of people I talk to are very surprised that a man like me had access to study women. Some people are even skeptical, because if you look at the literature, the vast majority of things written on women in Islam are by women, which is kind of, you know, a lot of the women who study women in Islam, they told me they didn't go to study women in Islam. They went to study broader Islamic themes, but they were kind of shunted into spaces in which women are living. When they went to talk to the men, they just kind of naturally, you know, because of the way things work in a lot of Muslim communities, they end up getting, you know, people to say, well, go talk, you know, hang out with the women while they're chopping onions. And so the women end up learning a lot about the way households function and women, women's interests and things like that. And for me, it was very different. People would mention women, but it was one thing that kind of surprised me and that a lot of people find a little bit incredible is that I had very little problems interviewing women. As soon as I expressed an interest in interviewing women, I could go and I could sit with her as long as I wanted. A lot of my interviews went 3-4 hours. I would come back the next week and interview her again. I'd never found anyone, any of these women leaders who were hesitant at all, who were skeptical. I never had a problem assessing women and talking to them. I think what, and one thing I acknowledge in my preface is that me being a man, my being a man didn't necessarily limit my access to interviewing women, but I think it did change the perspective of this book significantly. And I think this book is a very different book from what we would have had if we had had a woman researching it. And that's because for me to hang out with women, it wasn't a hard thing to do. But it was definitely something I had to go out of my way to do. I had to tell people, I had to tell my research assistants, I want to go interview women, find me some more women to interview. Men, I would just go out and hang out, and I would naturally hang out with men and learn their perspectives. I didn't have to go out of my way to learn men's perspectives. I did have to go out of my way to learn women's perspective. So there's a lot less in this book if you compare it to what other people have written about women, West African women, Muslim women. You find that there's a lot less about household economics, about marriage and divorce, about about fertility. A lot of the issues that really deeply interest most women in West Africa, what you find is much more an emphasis on women's public performance of authority. How do they account for themselves explicitly and discursively? Because this is what the interviews were focused on. I would say, tell me your life story. And they would themselves select which aspects of the life story to tell me. They wouldn't talk much about, and I do have a chapter in here about cooking, but it's very much about how do they present cooking as an important part of their leadership? And how, what did I observe when I went to large meetings about cooking? But it's a lot less about some of the nuts and bolts about cooking that you find in some of the other works. So it is a very different perspective, but I didn't have any problem accessing women. As far as interviewing went, Senegal is a place that, compared to a lot of parts of the Muslim world, it's level of segregation is relatively low. Any man can visit any woman anytime they want, as long as it's under certain conditions. I mean, you can't necessarily go and sit privately with a woman without anybody there. But, you know, these women themselves are used to having young men around them all the time. So when I was doing an interview, it was extremely rare that I would do an interview one-on-one with a woman. I would do an interview in her living room, or occasionally in her bedroom, because a lot of religious leaders, men and women, receive people in their bedrooms. And there would be people coming and going, people sitting at the same time that I was interviewing. People would be coming and asking for spiritual instruction, and she would shift her interest from me to the people, other people present. So they were very used to being surrounded by men. So it was nothing out of the ordinary that I would go and ask them questions, and they were very honored by the idea that I was there to write a book about them. So it was really that it wasn't a problem, but it definitely did change. Being a man definitely changed the direction and the emphasis of the book.
Because it's fascinating, because when I've worked in Sri Lanka, it's been the opposite, where as you said, I get pushed towards the women's spaces, which is interesting, because as a female researcher, you're kind of, that's the space that you occupy where it's harder to, I guess, transgress or enter into male-dominated spaces. So it does raise really fascinating questions of accessibility and what stories you do get to tell, right? And I think that dynamic in this book is very interesting to me.
Mm-hmm. And can I add something to this question of women and men in spaces? You know, the question often comes up as I'm talking to people about my research. Some people, when I give these women as examples of women who are doing things that men have traditionally done, some people have told me, Yeah, but that's because they've been admitted into the space of being honorary men. And sometimes researchers get admitted into that space. So we have researchers who sometimes will be admitted into the spaces that are really only occupied by, as far as locals go, by men. But women are admitted because they're foreigners, they have a PhD, or they're from a university. And some people say that they get treated as honorary men. But I think if you look at it, one thing I say in this book is, it very well may be that there's no such thing as an honorary man. I think people become honorary men in some respects for a certain amount of time. But in the end, men are men and women are women. And the working title of my second book is Women Who Are Men. And this is a paradox. And I think a lot of people are going to mistake what the book is really about. I might change it for that reason. But it's about this idea that women never actually get, they speak of themselves in the Sufi tradition as men, but they never actually get treated by men 100%. So there's no such thing as a woman who is really, in every respect, socially, spiritually, a man, considered a man, and just, you know, has the same social existence as a man. There are women who overcome certain aspects of femininity in certain respects, but they also will use femininity. So that, I mean, overcoming in this sense is that there are some limitations to being a woman, but there are some advantages I talk about in my book. So, and I think as a foreign researcher, as somebody who is doing research with it, you might have been treated as an honorary man or in some circumstances, but then once things kind of go back to their everyday, you know, in your everyday existence, you in many ways are going to be a woman as well. So that's going to affect you no matter what. There's no such thing as transcending gender.
Yeah. And I think that's precisely the dynamic or the ambiguity that you're trying to raise in terms of discussing performance or how these women perform certain realities of piety or spirituality. But before we just get to there, so I'm kind of wanting to set up the landscape or the religious landscape, the Sufi community of the Tijaniya movement and the Feda, are they a branch within this movement? I'm wondering broadly in terms of where you could situate them in the context of West African Islam or just broadly just West African religiosity for perhaps listeners who don't know that landscape too much.
Yeah, sure. So the Tijani Sufi Tariqa was founded by a man named Sheikh Ahmed Tijani, who was born in a town or in a village in Algeria called Ain Mahdi, and he moved eventually to the city of Fez in Morocco, where he's buried now. And he got a certain number of followers around him, but in Morocco. But during his lifetime, he got several followers who were from Mauritania, from sub-Saharan Africa. And they spread his teachings and his tariqa to sub-Saharan Africa. So it became really, for about, you know, over a century, the Tijani tariqa was very, very heavily a West African tariqa. Even though it was founded in Morocco, it became very much associated with West Africa, to the point that today when I go to Morocco, I've heard tour guides that just a couple of months ago, I was in his burial place, the Zawiya of Sheikh Ahmed Tijani in Fez. And I heard a tour guide going by talking to some tourists in French saying, this is the burial place of Sheikh Ahmed Tijani, who was an African. And by African, they mean sub-Saharan African. African man who was traveling through Morocco and died here. So they buried him. So they're kind of describing him as a black African. And then he said that he occupies such an important place that West Africans think that this place is more important than Mecca. So they come here on pilgrimage instead of Mecca. Of course, this is completely false. Tijanis are Muslims. They perform the pilgrimage, but they also, many of them will go to Fez as well to visit his grave because he's a very important figure for them. But that's kind of the association that it got over the years that this is an African tariqa, West African tariqa specifically. And if you were to count the numbers of Tijanis in the world, the vast majority would be, like I said, originally in West Africa, Senegal, especially Nigeria, Northern Nigeria. There were a lot in Northern Nigeria. And it was only, so the Fayda began, it was founded by Sheikh Ibrahim Nias, who was born in 1900. And around, the dates sometimes are a little bit hazy about when he actually met certain figures and went to Nigeria. But the most instrumental event in his life, the thing that really changed things for his global reputation was when he went on his pilgrimage in 1937 to Mecca. And in Medina as well, where the Prophet Muhammad is buried. And he met the emir, or the ruler of Kano in northern Nigeria, a very, very important center of Islamic learning and scholarship and trade in northern Nigeria. And the emir of Kano became convinced that Sheikh Ibrahim was the spiritual leader he was looking for. Now, up until that point, Sheikh Ibrahim, he had announced, he had founded this Faida community in the Tijani. And Faida means flood. It's an Arabic word that means flood or inundation, overflowing, abundance. And it was something that was kind of cryptically predicted by the founder of the Tijani order, Sheikh Ahmed Tijani. He said that at a time of extreme hardship, there would come among his followers a faida, a flood, a effusion of divine knowledge, and that the tariqa would then spread afwaja, meaning it would go from, you know, groups and groups and groups of people would enter as groups, not just one, two, three, but a whole group of millions of people would enter the tariqa. So a lot of people had been actually discussing who would be the bringer of this faida, and several people had claimed that status before Sheikh Ibrahim. And so he claimed that status around 1929 openly in Senegal, and a number of people had come to him. But at that point in Senegal, he was still he was a young guy. He was only around 30 years old at that time. He was not really a big figure. And he had gotten the adherence of a number of the younger members of Mauritanian families, and the Mauritanians were the ones who brought the Tijaniyya. So this brought him a lot of prestige, that it was the junior members of these families, but they were members of the main families of the Tijani families in Mauritania. So he had a certain reputation in some quarters, but his followership was relatively small. But this changed after his pilgrimage in 1937 when the Emir of Kano came, and it was later when he visited Kano that he got the adherence of many, many people. And then after that, literally millions of people in the 1940s. By the late 1940s, millions of Nigerians had been his followers. He was the main Tijani leader in northern Nigeria. So it's kind of paradoxically, within Senegal, a lot of people don't even know that Sheikh Ibrahim's followers are Tijanis. Because when you say Tijanis, you're talking in Senegal about people from Tiwawan, followers of Hadj Maliksi. They call them Nyasens. People think that Nyasen is a separate tariqa because they just don't understand this whole history. So in Senegal, they're very widely misunderstood. At least they were up until around 2000 when they exploded within Senegal. But up until then, they were very marginalized. But even though they were very misunderstood and marginal within Senegal, in Nigeria, they had become the dominant Tijani group. And then they spread from Nigeria to other West African countries. So in most of West Africa, when you say Tijani, you're talking about followers of Sheikh Ibrahim Niass, except for in his own country of Senegal, where you're usually talking about other groups when you say Tijani, and you have to say Nyasen or Faida when you're talking, or Talibé Bai, which means followers of Sheikh Ibrahim, when you're talking about his followers. So worldwide, and then it was, they became the dominant branch of the Tijani group. Not only they became the dominant branch, but it was through this branch of the Tijaniyya that the Tijaniyya spread throughout the world and from Nigeria to other West African countries. And a big role in this spreading was played by Sheikh Ibrahim's grandson, Sheikh Hassan Sise, who passed away in 2008. He was assigned to represent the group in the United States, and he got a lot of American followers and then spread from there to other countries. And then there are a number of leaders now who have global following. So it's become a very global movement, although my book doesn't really focus on the global aspect, because really it's focused on ethnographic work within Senegal. But that's kind of the landscape of the Tijaniyya. And now my research is focusing a bit more on the global aspect than it did originally.
Yeah, because you do several times, and even with speaking with some of the female leaders, the connections to the transnational, particularly to Europe and North America or in Canada to Montreal, is quite fascinating. And so I was curious about that. And one of the other things I really enjoyed was the popular culture element, especially with hip hop and music, right? You are singing. Now I have a sense of why you were also interested in it, because you're coming from a music background. But in terms of the dominance of this group, you see that a lot of urban youth were gravitating towards the movement, and that's mainly through pop culture as well.
Yeah, and sometimes I joke with people. I'm only half joking, but I'm mostly joking that my third book, hopefully, I'm working on another book on hip hop, and I'm thinking that it would be a funny thing to call it Rapping Authority, just take off the W, but I think that might be a little bit too confusing for people. But it's very funny that I've gone from this idea of rapping, which is the central kind of semiotic concept, conceptual idea in this book, to rapping. More recently, I've interviewed dozens of rappers about their role in spreading the Fayda Tijaniya movement among young people. Because it's been, since its beginning, it's been, this is what differentiates it from many other branches of the Tijaniya that I've looked at, that I've visited. Usually when you go to Tijaniya meetings in most countries, the people sitting in the meeting are mostly above the age of 50 or 60, but you go to Fayda Tijaniya movements, meetings, and the vast majority of people there will be between the ages of 15 and 25, maybe 30. And it's been like that since the very beginning, since Sheikh Ibrahim founded the movement when he was around 30 himself, and most of his followers were under his age. So it's been a very big youth movement.
Mm-hmm. And so within the Fayda movement, I guess the main pivot of the book is that you're engaging with the new female leaders or the new Mukaddimahs, and you kind of are pointing to the two distinctive, or what you see as the two distinctive differentiations with what's happening within this movement that may be different from other, maybe female authorities that we've seen in other studies. So did you want to walk us through that? And I think that then leads us to the semiotic that you're talking about, which is rapping, not rapping music, but rapping. Wrapping in terms of physically wrapping something around your body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this book, because I had a lot of data about women in different times and places, and women who are, for example, sons of daughters of Sheikh Ibrahim, who will also describe themselves as sons because there's a whole metaphor of women as men. This book, I decided, just for the sake of narrowing it down, to focus on a particular category of women who I call the new Mukaddimahs. Because there have been, since the early 1800s at least, there have been women who have been appointed as Muqaddams, or representatives of the order, who have had the authority to transmit the litanies of the order. But it's only since around the year 2000, in usually urban contexts, that we've seen women openly acting publicly, because very often they would act quietly, without really people knowing, without public recognition. And since around 2000, that women, first of all, the women have been publicly leading men and women, so not just women. So in the past, people like Nana Asma'u, who's the most famous woman leader in West African history, she lived in the early 19th century. She was the daughter of Usman Danfodio, the founder of the Sokoto Caliphate. She was assigned to represent her father, essentially, to the women, the female population. And she would go to women's houses, and she would train people to women to go to women's houses, especially new Muslim women, to teach them their religion, because they thought it was very important to teach women their religion so they could pray and teach their own children. But that was the pattern that was very much followed in northern Nigeria. That led to a whole history of women scholars and women teachers who would work within segregated women's spaces to teach women. So part of the idea of giving women religious authority was so you could maintain segregation, so that women wouldn't have to go visit a man to get instruction, so they could go and visit women. Whereas in Senegal, this pattern that I was seeing was very different. You saw women being in mixed gender spaces, being the leaders and the teachers of men and women, being in pretty close quarters to men and women, although maintaining a respectful distance physically from their male followers. So that was one main thing that I saw, that these were women that were leaders openly of men and women. And then the other dynamic that I saw that was very different was that these women, although some of them would say, you know, my grandfather was a Quranic teacher or whatever, none of them inherited their position from either a father or a husband. There's one example I talk about in this book of somebody whose husband is a religious leader, but I talk about her as marginally a new Muqaddimah because she's playing a different role in the last chapter of the book. But the people who are squarely new Muqaddimahs are women who became disciples, usually through some kind of visionary experience. At least this is how they describe it. I'm talking about their narratives. You know, they became disciples. They were led to be disciples of Sheikh Ibrahim and through some other Muqaddim who would give them the Tijani order and the tarbiyah, the spiritual education. And then they would be recognized as being outstanding disciples, and some male leader would give them an ijazah, or an appointment as a representative of the order of the tariqah, and they would become leaders in their own right. And it was all through their own merits as followers, not through inheriting some kind of mantle from their father. In many cases, like the other one case of a Senegalese woman that has been discussed in the literature, was a Murid woman named Sokhan Magat Diop, who came to occupy this position because her father died and didn't have any sons. And so because the inheritance is such an important thing, it had to be one of his children who took his mantle. So it went to his daughter, and they described her as somebody who was playing the role of a man. But in this case, it wasn't the case here that they inherited from their father. They were all people who mostly were not Talibabai to be born with. They were from other Sufi groups. Their families followed other leaders. and they became leaders in their own right, and they became disciples and then leaders.
And I have to say, one of the things I did love about the book are the, you know, I don't know if you'd call them oral histories, but merely the stories that you do tell of the women, especially in this chapter. You chronicle different women throughout the book, but in I think in the New Makadamas chapter, you chronicle three. And I wonder if there's any that you'd want to share at the moment, or like a particular story that stood out in terms of the females that you are chronicling in terms of the type of authority they're maintaining, how they're doing it.
Yeah, sure. So yeah, originally this chapter I had I profiled eight women, and then people read it and they said that it was a little too confusing to have too many women in the same chapter. So I narrowed it down to three who I thought represented very distinctive kind of life stories and histories. So I talk about Seida Busodrame. I talk about and she who lives on the far outskirts of Dakar in a relatively marginal area, although she told me just this year that she's planning to move because they're going to turn her area into a big catchment basin. So she's going to have to move to a different neighborhood, which she's okay with. So this is a kind of, you know, people who are living in these marginal areas where they can kind of kick you out whenever they want. And she's a very interesting character. Because she doesn't have much formal education. None of these women really have, you know, none of them have studied at Al-Azhar, like the male major male leaders in Cairo. None of them have an extended classical Islamic education. Although all of them have studied the Quran. Pretty much every child in Senegal, every Muslim child, boy or girl, studies the Quran to a certain degree. That's not really distinctive of them because everybody does. But none of them have studied. Usually to become a religious leader, you'd have to study past the Quran. You'd have to study fiqh or Islamic jurisprudence. You'd have to study some of the other topics and then have a long spiritual apprenticeship with a leader. And none of them really have that. But Seida Busodrame, because she is very much a curious person herself, she's sought out learning herself. She's gone to various teachers. Her family has employed, when she was younger, employed teachers to teach in her house. And now she employs Quranic teachers to teach the Quran in her house to other people. So she's, when you hear her talk, she sounds like somebody who has read quite widely, but it's all through informal education. Contrast that to another woman I talk about here, Khadifal, who has, I believe, five post-secondary, you know, university diplomas, was a government minister at some point, has for many years been a senior member of the education ministry in Senegal, a very prominent member of society, much more known, and also the author of many books on German literature, much more known as a German professor at the university and a government education official than as a spiritual guide. But around 2000, I'm blanking on some of the years, but she was appointed as a representative of the Tijani order, and she came to have disciples, her own disciples, and so now she has a circle of disciples that meets in her house. Several of them gone to live in Europe. So that's very contrasting. She also did not have much formal Islamic education. Her education is all in French and German. And then the third person I talk about in this chapter is the one who is on the cover of the book, Ndai Zainab Mbadj. Who is her own kind of model of leadership. She, her work is that she is a kind of a spirit medium. She uses her spirit medium gifts to give people advice, to tell them what's causing their problems. And this is something that is she considers a separate work from her spiritual, so her Sufi leadership. Because this is her kind of her private job that she gets money from, but her Sufi leadership, she doesn't have an income from. She just, you're not supposed to make an income from it. But it definitely plays into her authority because it helps her with her kind of air of mystique that she has a spiritual connection to the other world. And she's become herself quite a prominent leader in her neighborhood of Sikab Dakhli in Dakar. And then I talk about a number of other leaders in this book. Who another very interesting one is Seida Musokoro Mbaye, who I talk about in two subsequent chapters. Who I first had in this chapter, and then I moved her just because I talked about her enough in the other chapters. I didn't need to repeat it in that chapter. But she's also one of these people who's very prominent outside of her Sufi activities. She has a large corporation, a large company that imports and markets skincare products and haircare products. And she started in the clothing business, and then she's did this haircare products of things that are made in Côte d'Ivoire. And she's done very well for herself, mashallah. But in addition to that, she has her. So most of these women have other occupations aside from being a spiritual guide. So this is something they kind of do on the side of their other occupation, which kind of goes against the idea that women, Muslim women, don't work, because all these women have, you could say, two jobs. They have their spiritual job and they have their money job. Although some of them are pretty much housewives or whatever, they don't really have another economic source of income. Like Ida Cham is another one who mostly just devotes her life to spiritual endeavors, but she is also living in the kind of outskirts of Dakar, in a more marginal area, and is kind of struggling to get by. But she's also become very prominent in her area as somebody who's known as a youth leader and an organizer of the Faitha community.
So the second half of the book really is engaging with these women's lives and experiences, and really around performance. So you kind of go into the sphere of cooking, the sphere of how they're engaging with motherhood, the voice, kind of the politics around women's voices. And all of this is centered around this question that you're kind of grappling with in terms of performance of piety and the gender dynamics that are associated with, and you're building it or constructing it around this notion of rapping. So I wonder if you could walk us through that and why you're interested in rapping, what you're trying to subvert and using rapping, and particularly in kind of positioning it against the veil, and why I think it's so interesting in the context of Sufism, because there's like a really mystical component to the veil as well, which I was really fascinated about how you tied that together. So.
Yeah. Yeah. So first, to talk about the idea of rapping. I decided to make that the central idea of the book because, yeah, it challenges the way we've been talking about Muslim women for a long time. Because if you look at the literature on Muslim women for the last, well, I was going to say a couple of decades, but probably ever since Orientalists started talking about the Middle East, the veiled Muslim woman is the central kind of image, and some people have seen my title and misconstrued it, which is not their fault, but they thought I was just talking about veiling again. It's another book about veiling. And in Senegal, veiling is not such a huge issue. Most women don't really, even the Sufi women, don't necessarily veil in the sense that we think of using the what they know as the reformist veil. They do dress modestly by their own standards. But even members of this particular Sufi group, they don't necessarily cover their heads all the time. Not all of them anyway. So the point is not to say, well, let's look at veiled Muslim women again. The point is to say that there is, even among women who don't necessarily veil rigorously in the way that a lot of reformists would like them to veil, they're exercising some kind of what I would call self-wrapping. And the reason why I choose the word wrapping instead of veiling is that veiling really is a negative action. It's about concealing. It's about hiding. It's about what are you not showing? And another thing about veiling is that because it has such a long history of being associated with women, that it kind of cuts the idea of veiling off from the many other areas in which the same logic is applying. So I use wrapping as a semiotic concept. In other words, I'm interested in what does it mean to wrap something? And so in the chapter on wrapping, I go into the many, many meanings of and uses of wrapping in our societies, in the West, in various Muslim contexts, to show that wrapping, of course, has many different connotations. Wrapping can be used to protect something, to keep it from getting scuffed up. It can be used to hide it, to keep people from knowing that you have something valuable. So if you're walking around with diamonds and gold, you might want to show it off, but you also might, if you're in an area where it might get ripped off, you probably want to hide it. You want to wrap it up. So it can be a protective measure. It can also be a way of presenting something as valuable, which is what you would do with like a birthday present. It adds to the value. It adds to the mystique of it because it's, you get the present. It makes you more excited to get it if it's wrapped up because it makes you wonder what's in there. And so all of these things actually come to play when we're talking about the so-called veil or the wrapper. In some cultures, they actually, like in Mauritania, the women's covering is called a wrapper. It's the thing that wraps them. They don't call it a veil or a hider. They call it a wrapper. And a wrapper is something that conceals, presents, protects, embellishes, misleads. You can mislead by putting the wrong wrapper on something. You can overestimate, underestimate. It does a number of functions, and women's bodily covering can play all of those functions, and it can suggest protection. So when a woman, a lot of people told me, well, when they were talking about why it is that women cover themselves, they said, well, would you rather have, when somebody brings you food in Senegal, when you present food, you present it with the cover on and then you take the cover off when you're serving it. They said, would you rather that somebody bring you a plate that's been uncovered for a long time and you don't know if the flies have gotten it, if other people have been picking at it, if it's how long it's been out, or would you rather they bring you one that's covered that you know nobody has been messing around with? So that's, you know, this is, and we could have a long conversation about that, about what are the social implications of women messing around, people messing around with women. But the idea is that it's been protected and preserved. So I extend this from physical wrapping of the body to say that actually this, the wrapper is a semiotic, it's a sign of things that it can be a sign that is not physical, not about clothing, but about many other things. So your voice can be wrapped. So just to give the examples that I talk about in chapter 6 on the wrapped voice, people say the woman's voice is aura. In other words, people say aura is something that needs to be protected, covered, not to be shown publicly. So the body is aura. So they say that your aura is the part of your body that should not be shown. And for women, in traditional fiqh, that's the face and the hands. For men, it's a bit more extensive than that. And then they say that the woman's voice is aura. In other words, the woman's voice is something that shouldn't be shown. You can hear a woman's voice, but it, there's this idea that it shouldn't be put out there for everyone to hear at the same time. It should be a bit more modestly presented quietly. And a lot of people see that as very sexist. And of course, this can lead to women's exclusion from many spheres. But I talk about how in traditional Senegalese society, anyone who had a certain status would want to veil their voice or wrap their voice. So there was this category of people that we call griots in the Western languages, Gewel and Wolof. And they were the wrappers of the noble people. In other words, if the noble person wanted to announce something to somebody, they wouldn't go and tell that person. Or if you're at an assembly and there are a lot of people there, no microphones, in order for everyone to hear you, you had to really shout very loud. And it was very undignified for people to do that. And so you would employ a Gewel or anyone really of lower status. It could be a Gewel, it could be even a younger relative, or somebody who has a kind of client relationship to your family. And you would whisper to them what you want the people to hear, and then they would shout it out loud, maybe embellishing it themselves. So they're embellishing the same way that a rapper embellishes. So your voice can be wrapped. Nowadays, a microphone can play the role of the vocal rapper, because the microphone can allow you not to yell and to maintain your composure and dignity while reaching a large audience. YouTube can also be a rapper in a certain sense. And there's some controversy about whether YouTube is simply allowing you to be undignified in front of more people, or whether YouTube itself is a rapper because you're not physically present when you are presenting them. So they'll use this. So women who are actually playing the role of dhikr leaders or chant leaders, they will use all kinds of technological mediation in order to overcome the traditional imposition that women shouldn't be out there yelling. They also use the spiritual state as the rapper to present themselves, their voice, as something other than their own voice. If somebody asks them, they'll say, well, it's not my voice. It's the voice of Ilham. It's the voice of the kind of what's been inspired to them. They're in a different state. They're in an altered state of consciousness, which means, and it's the same kind of explanation you get in spirit possession and things like that. It's not my agency that's doing it. It's another agency that's doing it. So that kind of creates another rapper or the social role they're playing. And so I talk about many ways in which people socially can be wrapped. If you're delegating your roles to other people, delegating your representation to other people, those people end up being your wrapper. So you can be socially wrapped, vocally wrapped, visually wrapped through clothing and other things. And one of the main things I talk about here is that it can be connected to nobility. So it can make you seem more noble by being wrapped. So a lot in the West, we tend to think that if your voice is not directly heard, then you must be disenfranchised. In many cases, that's true. I'm not saying that, no, if you don't have a voice, it doesn't matter. I'm saying that there are certain contexts in which having your voice literally heard is actually lowers your status rather than raising it. So in traditional Senegalese society, that's the case. And in Sufism, the rapper has a very deep function, because the Sufi tradition presents God as somebody who is wrapped through 70,000 veils, as something based on hadith. that God is wrapped through 70,000 veils, and that you can get closer to God through getting through those veils, penetrating those veils. And so God is, it's only something that's really the object of desire and longing and value that would be wrapped in such a way. And so women can present, and so can, women can actually connect themselves to the divine through the mystical knowledge, the wrapped knowledge, the secret knowledge of Sufism through presenting themselves as physically wrapped people. So there's, I talk about the idea of the qualis sign, this idea that comes from Charles Sanders Peirce, the idea that many things that share the same quality, that quality can come to have a significance in itself because it connects you to many other things that have that quality. So the quality of raptness connects you to mystical knowledge. It connects you to nobility. It connects you to many other valuable things that are also wrapped. And so I talk about how it's all about the performative context. I'm not saying this makes them more valuable. I'm saying that it can be used in performances of authority to present themselves as more valuable. And it's only successful in making them more valuable if the performance works, if people actually, so you can't, it's not just about your performance. It's about how people take up the performance, how they interpret it, and how they value your performance. So it doesn't mean that anyone in any condition can wrap themselves and therefore have value. It's about in certain context, a certain performance of wrappedness can lead, it can contribute to your mystique or your value.
And in your epilogue, you return to this in terms of asking the readers to think about what the consequence of thinking about this kind of performative approach, performative gendered approach entails for studying of not only Sufism, but also broadly Islam in terms of perhaps what scholars should do in how we, you know, approach Islam or approach discursive traditions in Islam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I've been very deeply influenced by the approach of Talal Asad and his idea of Islam as a discursive tradition. And I think this is really a very valuable way of thinking about if we want to delineate Islam as a field of study, I don't think you could do better than talking about Islam as a discursive tradition. By that, Talal Asad wrote in this very famous paper on the idea of Islam as of an anthropology of Islam. He wrote that people had talked about Islam in many different ways. It's either an essence that's shared by all Muslims. It's many, whatever Muslims want it to be because, you know, we're cultural relativists, so everybody can define it in their own way. And ultimately, and then there's a third option that it's really nothing. It's analytically nothing because it doesn't have any coherent meaning at all because it is used to refer to so many different things. It doesn't really mean anything. And Talal Asad said, well, that kind of, this idea that it either has to be an essence or it's nothing is self-defeating, and it means that we can't have anything called Islamic studies. So he came up with this idea of Islam as a discursive tradition to deal with that question, everything that calls itself Islam, everything that's identified Islam, has something in common, and that thing that it has in common is not an essence. It's that it all refers back to some history, some claim to authoritatively representing this tradition of Islam, of representing the original texts of Islam, the Quran and the Hadith, and I would say even beyond Hadith, there's Sunnah beyond Hadith too. There's a number of different kind of authoritative sources for Islam. But where I find that this approach has, he said we should start with that. He didn't say Islam is that, and that is the ultimate definition of Islam. He said we should start with that when delineating the field of Islamic studies. And I think one problem is that when a lot of times when we've taken up this so-called definition of Islam, we've kind of privileged the discursive idea of Islam, and it's led to this kind of idea. And I'm not saying that Talal Asad is the one who's guilty of this, but it just kind of, this emphasis on discursive tradition has sometimes led us to think of Islam as something that's determined through discourse, something that it's ultimately a debate over orthodoxy. And I think actually a lot of what passes as Islam, it's not about who makes the best argument or who's referring to text. It's about who can perform in a way that is then kind of recognized as legitimate. And sometimes performances that are very different from what previously was known as a authoritative or acceptable performance of Islam get to be accepted without any kind of debate. And that was kind of the central question of this book. Wait a minute, all these women are acting as leaders in a place where women were generally understood as by definition excluded from leadership. And many people still approach it that way. Suddenly, since 2000, they become leaders. And I haven't heard very much controversy over this. And there was no central discussion about should we now, well, among certain groups there has been in Senegal, but among the Faida people, there has not been a discussion over whether women should be appointed as leaders. They just kind of came to be appointed and act publicly as leaders. without any real discursive debate over it, as far as we can tell. And my answer to the question of how that happened was, it's through this idea of performance. And it's something I've called in some of my other publications, performative apologetics. In other words, apologetics is the idea of making a case for the idea that your position is true. I think people often make their case through their performance, through performing a certain kind of piety, and then letting other people decide whether that piety flies as legitimate piety. And they might also, if you ask them, they might make a case for it discursively, but the discursive case is not really what determines whether it gets accepted or not. Most people are not listening to the discursive case. Most people are watching what they're doing. So I think what passes as good Islamic performance very often is determined very largely through non-discursive ways. And of course, discourse is always part of it. You can't exclude discourse. But I'm saying that ultimately it comes down to, when I look at a performance of Islam, do I say, wait a minute, that doesn't look right? Or do I say, I'd never thought about that, but I guess that works. It looks right to me. Those women are still acting very pious while they're doing this very non-traditional thing, so I guess that's okay. And there's no debate over it. Nobody actually raised the question of, well, should women be doing that? They just kind of looked at it and said, well, they look like they're pretty proper women to me, so that's all right. And so what they're doing, and so the way that I illustrate this through this book is I illustrate how these women are essentially, you've got a number of things that are considered the building blocks of good, pious womanhood. Like you mentioned, you've got cooking. There's nothing in the Quran or the Hadith that says women must stay home and cook. As far as I know, I've never heard of a hadith that says women should do the cooking. There are cases where it references women cooking, but it doesn't. There's nothing in there that normatively says women need to be the ones who cook. But there's this understanding that women are associated with. There is a Quranic verse that says, "Establish your qirna fi buyutkunna, establish yourselves in your homes." Which has been generalized to mean that women should be primarily in the house. They can go out. Some people say they can't go out, but the general understanding is that that's their main base of operation is the home, and raising children. And then who's going to do the cooking while you're there? You can either employ somebody, a servant, to do it, or the woman's going to do it, because she's already there. So women have become very deeply associated with cooking, and it's become a source of pride for them. So it's not something that they see as, I'm only a servant doing this. Even women who are very rich, who have lots of money, who don't need to cook, they take pride in the fact that the food in their house is done properly. And if they hire somebody else to do it, they're going to be looking over their shoulder to make sure it's done properly, because if somebody complains about the food, they ultimately bear responsibility, not their husbands, not other men in the household. So women have been associated with that. They've been associated with, like I said, wrapping and being wrapped up, being also like, for example, being docile and submissive to your husband. This is something that I say in the book that, of course, it can be the idea of being submissive to your husband can be a very marginalizing thing for women, of course. But if it's part of a performance in which the viewer and the performer understand this performance as a performance of piety before God and not necessarily before the husband, then a woman can actually redefine a performance of piety toward her husband as a performance of piety toward God. Like if onlookers know that the man is actually in a less prominent position than his wife, like she's a very important leader, he's just some no-name guy. If she's showing subservience before him, then that just actually emphasizes her humility and her spiritual connection to God and her piety. And the guy knows that he couldn't take advantage of that because she's the much more prominent person. So that performance of subservience comes to have a very different meaning. Of course, I'm not defending that women should be subservient. I'm just saying that it comes to have different meanings depending on the context, the performative context. So there are a number of different domains that they... Oh, and then motherhood is maybe the central one in which women are performing female piety and every feminine piety, and every woman that I talk to use motherhood as a metaphor of spiritual leadership. And what's really striking about this is that you might think, oh yeah, well, you know, and people have told me this when I presented this, people have said, well, you know, in West Africa, fictive kinship is important. So men describe themselves as father, women describe themselves as mother, no big deal. But actually, men's use of paternal metaphors is extremely limited. When men come to have a relationship to somebody, they often refer to them as uncle or something like that. But the term Bai, father, is reserved for the founder of this community, Sheikh Ibrahim Nias. That's his main nickname, Bai, father. But a household can have one father, but it can have several mothers because of polygyny. So in the Faida community, women in general can define themselves as mothers in ways that men can't define themselves as fathers. And so spiritual transmission in this community is very rarely defined as a relationship, or not as often defined as a relationship of fatherhood between the person doing the transmitting and the disciple, because the disciple is understood to be a more a spiritual son or daughter of Sheikh Ibrahim than the local muqaddim who's giving them giving them the spiritual training. But the women can use the metaphor of motherhood as a leadership metaphor. So it shows that they're using those, what's essentially in this, the way they're using it is very novel, because such kinship metaphors have been used in the history of Sufism. I talk about this. They've been used in the history of Sufism quite a bit, but often to describe men's leadership. But it was very rare in the history of Sufism that you had women using maternal metaphors. Actually, most women who were Sufi figures avoided the idea of motherhood. They avoided marriage, or they avoided the stigma or the kind of like biological implications of impurities of women's reproduction. So they avoided any connection to motherhood. Whereas members of this group, the women in this group, that's the central metaphor they're using all the time, motherhood. So it becomes a huge part of their performance. Even women who don't have children, or women whose children are all gone, or women who are divorced, they all use this motherhood metaphor as part of the performance of piety. So it's kind of like the elements of feminine piety are building blocks through which you can build what some people would describe as an oppressive relationship. But these women are showing how you can reconfigure those building blocks to build something very different. So it just shows that the indeterminate nature of using the building blocks of feminine piety, that it's all in the current performance and how they're being put together in this particular situation.
And in many ways, it seems to almost resonate with other studies of, you know, Sufi women, either in classical context or in contemporary context, where there is a negotiated reality of how they could embody authority or embody their own locality as gendered beings, right? Because there's a sense that Sufism allows for the transcendence of gender, but there's also the social cultural reality in which one is physically existing in as well. So I think the book highlights that through these women's voices and examples, how at times they affirm certain tendencies that may seem to perpetuate this binary, such as, you know, mother-father dynamics and other tendencies in which they're actually enacting agency and subverting, such as, you know, cooking that's taken on as a pious act that's significant to them, right? There's so many jewels in the book that we won't be able to get to. But hopefully readers can pick it up and explore further. But as we conclude, you hinted at already at some of the work that you're doing, but what else can we expect from you in the future?
So, yeah, well, there's a tradition in Islam and Sufism that you don't put all your cards out on the table. Even the sheikhs that I know, a lot of them, even if they know that they're inshallah traveling tomorrow, they won't tell anybody until they're getting on the plane, and they'll say, yeah, I might be going somewhere tomorrow. And then they'll go. So I feel a little bit, I wonder if I should, but it's kind of a matter of public knowledge that this book, and I say it in the introduction, this book is kind of, it's a subset of my research on women. And some people will be disappointed to learn that when they open this book that I didn't talk about the most prominent women leaders in Senegal, who are the daughters of Sheikh Ibrahim himself. And that's because I was reserving, and I've already written this material up, and I went back and talked to some of them again, so I'm going to be updating it based on things that I got this year, or this in the past year. But I have a second book that kind of spun off of this, so it's kind of a two-part project. And the second book, instead of talking about the new muqaddamas, it's talking about the longer tradition of women in Sufism and in Islam. And so in that book, that's where I'm planning to talk about the daughters of Sheikh Ibrahim who don't fit at the new muqaddama label, because A, they're more classically trained, they've memorized the Quran, they've studied the disciplines, Islamic disciplines, they're the daughters of a major leader, so that makes them the more traditional model of women Islamic figures. But I'm going to place them in the context of the longer tradition of Sufism. So how do they fit in with people like Rabi' al-Adawiyya and Fatima ibn Shapur and these other figures? And Nana Asma'u, of course, from northern Nigeria, the huge figure who's already been talked about by many scholars in West Africa. And so I'm going to be talking about a lot of broader gender issues and in Sufism. And then I have another project that I published a bit on, which is still the book project is still more in its nascent stages, but that's about hip hop and other forms of performance in Senegal again. And I've extended that research to look at London. So I've interviewed a lot of Sufi rappers in London who have become very good friends of mine, who are very prominent in the Tijani community over there. People like Rakin Yas, Muhammad Yahya, Sakina Douglas, Monita Williams in the London scene. And this kind of takes a different direction gender wise, because hip hop, as everybody knows, is very deeply dominated by men, and it's a very masculine field. So when you have all the rappers I interviewed in Senegal, with the exception of one, were men, because I couldn't find very many women rappers. And in London, I interviewed two female rappers who are known as the hip hop hijabis in London. And they actually are a little bit against this usage, because it kind of, again, it reduces them to women who wear the veil. Oh, there are women who wear the veil and do hip hop. Isn't that novel? But that's, you know, there's been a documentary made on them called That Hip Hop Hijabis. So I'm kind of extending that to the more international sphere, and I'm looking more at Sufism and the Faida in an international, you know, this transnational perspective. So the next book, yeah, inshallah, will be a continuation kind of this gender theme, but in a broader sense.
That's all sounds very fascinating and actually very exciting. So I look forward to reading your future work. Thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for inviting me. I've enjoyed it.